history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, it's pretty amazing the perspective we pick up. We're educated, we're entertained, often we're really inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And inspiration is the business Gail Halvorsen has been in for a long time. For some of you, just my saying that name brought instant recognition. But for the rest of you, spend this next hour with us and you're not going to forget that name either. Around the world, he's known by quite a few names. You can call him Colonel, you can call him Hal, Uncle Wackelflügel, that's German for Uncle Wiggly Wings, and maybe he's best known as the Candy Bomber, or should I say the Berlin Candy Bomber. That's the title of his book, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But Gail Halvorsen just turned 100 years old and received quite an honor in his home state of Utah. So I wanted to make that the focus of our time here on the radio this week. I had the privilege of sitting down with Colonel Halvorsen a few years back to record the whole story of how he became the Candy Bomber. And we're going to hear that, but first let's hear the voice of a centenarian, Colonel Gail Halvorsen, on the phone from Provo, Utah. And it sounds like you've had quite the week.
Yeah, we're having a big time. People are really great this town.
Well, I guess I should also say happy belated birthday. I'm sorry I missed the big occasion, but what was that like for you on your birthday?
Well, 10th of October in 1920, and just like old times, like last year's, and if I can keep it that way, I'll be in good shape.
Do you feel 100 yet?
Heavens, no. No, I'm still flying, and get along good in the world. I'm having a good time.
So what all did they do for you on your birthday on Saturday?
Well, we had a birthday cake, of course, with a large number of cattle. Couldn't get them all on there, but anyway, we had a good time with the family, and you know, we didn't do any big deals, but we had a good birthday, and people mattered, family and your neighbors, and so it was good.
And there was more than a few vehicles, I think, driving by in front of the house there, right?
Yeah, there sure was. I was pretty amazed at the people here that knew when my birthday was. So it's just a number, I hope.
100 is just a number, but it's a pretty big number, and that number is dwarfed by the amount of mail he'll be swimming through between now and his 101st birthday next October. Cards and letters from all over the world, not to mention a larger-than-life tribute to him in Tremont, Utah, where he spent plenty of time over the years. We're going to hear about that a little later, and how you can help the Candy Bomber and his namesake foundation accomplish one goal that's still out in front of him. But I want you to hear some of his story. You definitely can't fit his whole life's journey into an hour. It'd probably take that long just to catalog all the U.S. presidents and foreign heads of state he's met. But I do want you to get a feel for what made him who he is and how he became the Candy Bomber. So let's have him take us back to his formative years in the Beehive State.
Well, the things I remember back then was growing up on the farm in Garland, Utah, was to appreciate food and love, and that's about all we had during the Depression, and hard work on the farm. But it was good work. It was a good way to grow up. Working out in the field and throwing hay up in the hay wagon or thinning sugar beets, see an airplane come out through the blue sky and head up north to Idaho. And I'd stop and watch, and Dad said, well, you watch long enough, get back to work. And I was enthralled with airplanes from the beginning. So that was in my blood. The contrast was the farm work every day, and it was a good life, a really good life. I don't know how I could have more love and hard work and good lessons from a good dad and mom. Out of high school in 1941, before the war started, I competed with a bunch of guys in Salt Lake, Ogden, and Northern Utah for a flight scholarship. We had about 140 going to ground school, and they gave 10 scholarships. Well, I memorized everything being in the farm, so I got a free ride to get a private pilot license, me and 10 other guys. We didn't have any money, but we pulled up $50 a piece, and that's $500, and bought an airplane. It was a Franklin 55 horsepower engine with single ignition. That means if the ignition quits, you're a glider. So you learn to look out for emergency landing places. So I had a great time with that, and we got going, and Pearl Harbor came along, and of course we signed up and got in the Army Air Corps. But that's how I got started to fly, and I loved it. I got a lot of time. Didn't have any money to buy gas so that airplane. Spent my $50 on buying the airplane with other guys. So I had a really good buddy, Conrad Steffen, in Tremont, in Utah. He wanted to see what flying was like. I said, well, I'm an expert. I got 35 hours. I'll show you how to do it. And so I gave him a ride, and he bought all the gas. So I flew a lot because he had a pretty good bank account. So we did a lot of flying together. I sure enjoyed Conrad Steffen.
Well, and you mentioned then Pearl Harbor happened, and then you ended up in the Army Air Corps after that. What do you remember about that day and how that news hit you, that all of a sudden your country has been attacked and the world has changed a little bit? Do you remember how you found out?
Yes, I was listening to a car radio. I had even had a radio in those days. good for radio. I love it. I love radio. But just the news broke up and the man came in. I thought they was doing one of these crazy shows, you know. I just didn't believe it. The Japanese, clear over there from Japan, would be bombing Pearl Harbor. It was beyond my belief. And then I thought, well, I'm glad I got a pilot license. I know I won't be. So I felt sorry for the guys slugging on the ground, our buddies that was part of the team. But I always wanted to fly. So I remember it. I just didn't believe it for a while. So I got a local radio broadcast that said it's true, that's underway. And so we were very much concerned then for the future, my buddies and I at that time.
And again, I know we can only scratch the surface of your story, and I hope everyone looks at your website to learn all about you and check out the incredible pictures if you want to learn more about the Candy Bomber. I've got that linked at hometownheroesradio.com. But again, long before you're the Candy Bomber, you're just a pilot in the Army Air Corps. Did you have an idea of what you wanted to fly? Were you thinking, I'd really love to fly fighters, or I'd like to be on a 10-man bomber crew? What were you thinking would be good?
At that time, of course, the real heroes for me were the RAF pilots defending Great Britain. The guys that are flying day and night, going up at night to intercept the German bombers. I was just enthralled with those. And Chesley Peterson was a guy that lives not in Utah, not too far. He had enlisted in the RAF quite a bit earlier. And he added another dimension, knowing the Utah guy was out there flying the RAF before Pearl Harbor. So they were my ideal. And when I signed up for aviation cadet training, and when we got to San Antonio, Texas for pre-flight, they had a notice on the board. It said, who wants to train with the RAF? And man, I ran in right quick and said, hey, I want to train with the RAF. They said, well, okay, we'll talk to you about it. And the Brits were training their pilots in the States during the bombing. Of course, they had more room in Canada and the United States. So I ended up in the flight training, RAF training in Miami, Oklahoma. That's how I got into the business and ended up with the Royal Air Force as a fighter pilot. When I got sent back to the Army Air Corps, they needed cargo guys. And that was a blow. But anyway, I really enjoyed my time flying the transport business in lots of parts of the country, and that got me into Berlin Airlift, so that's not all bad.
Was there ever a point as you're training, and you say your heroes were the guys defending Great Britain and all those Spitfires and the mosquito bombers and everything that they were flying over there, was there ever a point as you're pursuing these aviation dreams that you thought, you know, I might be risking my life here?
Well, growing up on the farm, I used to try to ride my brother's horse. His horse was beyond my regular skill level, and when he'd take off, I'd ride his horse. So I always had a feeling of maybe pushing the envelope a little bit there. I had no real fear of flying. A few times in the air, I questioned that decision, but I just knew that I was going to fly no matter what happens. And I had confidence in the mechanics and the equipment, and if you end up being a glider, there must be a place to land it somewhere, miss the neighbor's house and land in the field. No, I didn't ever really have any apprehension about getting up in the airplane.
Well, that's the second time that's come up, that a, you know, engine-powered aircraft could become an engineless aircraft, and you could become a glider, and it's probably a little easier to to accomplish that in that Franklin you had at first than a big cargo plane. Were there some times in your career where you had to deal with those kind of situations where you lost engine power?
Yes. Taking off out of Rio de Janeiro one day and looked out there, and all of a sudden my right engine was engulfed in flames. I mean, it was just burning. I was in the Rio de Janeiro harbor, had hardly any altitude, and there was a big fire going on. But it went through the regular procedure, feathering the engine, stopping the engine, putting out the fire extinguisher to that engine, just pull the handle and get the fire extinguisher, and put the fire out, got the engine feathered. The problem was I was maximum gross weight. I was headed from Rio de Janeiro to Brazil, northern Natal, Brazil, on the north coast. And so I was maximum gross weight, but I was at sea level. So I got there, got around on one engine and put it back down again. Well, I've had lost several engines, so to speak, and four-engine airplane, but that's no problem. If it doesn't burn up on you. Well, I've lost an engine on the airlift, too, several times. But four engines is pretty comfortable. It's not like losing one of two.
Well, and I think there are a lot of people out there saying easy for you to say, and maybe they wouldn't be so confident in that. And you mentioned Rio de Janeiro, and I guess the timeline is important on that, because probably a lot of people, and all the veterans we have on this show, you know, primarily they served in Europe, or they served somewhere in the Pacific, maybe early on they were in North Africa, maybe up in the Aleutians, but it's not very often that you hear about South America during the World War II era. But that's where you were during that time. Can you explain what you were doing and what the significance of it was?
That was unusual. You know, I put in for fighters and then up in transports. But when they assigned me, to South Atlantic Theater. And we were flying supplies from Florida all the way down to Rio de Janeiro. But that was when we had twin-engine airplanes. Then we got the C-54. Well, I was in Natal, Brazil. We were stationed in Natal, Brazil. I got assigned a C-54 then. And then we started flying out of Natal east to Ascension Island in Africa. And that was a good run. And out of Natal, we would ferry airplanes. If the guys were bringing down a bomber that was going to England to replace aircraft there, they'd go the southern route in the wintertime down to Natal to Ascension Island, then on over to Africa, and then up to England. And sometimes the airplane would break down in Natal. My buddies and I would draw straws to see who got to deliver it to England while the war was going on. But I did that a couple of times, and I enjoyed that. I had quite a lot of variety flying out of there, but flew missions mostly to Ascension Island and Africa and back to the States occasionally, and as far south as Argentina. It was a challenging environment, nothing like being shot at. Those guys always had my admiration, and I felt kind of left out, in a way, but I was doing what I was told to do, and I did the best job I could.
I hear you mention Ascension Island, and I've had some guys who, you know, made a hop there in a B-24 or a B-17 getting over to North Africa or Italy, and I've heard some horror stories about trying to find that place and the weather that you would deal with on the way there. And it strikes me that even though you didn't have people shooting at you as you're ferrying supplies or airplanes, you probably did have Mother Nature throw you a few curveballs. Any memorable instances where you thought the weather was going to take you out?
Well, of course, I've had times when severe weather, but gosh, everybody else has too. Yeah. And I trusted the instruments and the airplane, and we had a great navigator getting to Ascension. I kept that alive for about 18 months, three trips a week from Brazil to Ascension Island. We always found the island. We had a good navigator. We'd take off in the evening, and so the navigator would have the stars at night, and we didn't have too much really bad weather on that route. And one of my navigators that seemed to be more precise than most anybody, you just knew you're going to split the island 5x7. The island's only 5x7 miles. It was a Navajo Indian who had graduated from navigator school, and he was incredible. Maybe he had a sixth sense, too, but he trusted the instruments as I did. But it was an interesting trip hitting Ascension Island. There were a few that missed it and had no other place to go. You just land in the ocean. But I didn't have any real angst about that, any worry about that.
What about when World War II came to a close? Well, the war in Europe, VE Day. Was that a big deal to you? I mean, here you've been carrying all these supplies, flying all these flights, trying to support this overall effort. When you got that news that Germany had surrendered. Did that mean something?
Yeah, I meant that some of my buddies who were doing the heavy work were going to be able to come home. And it was the end of losing some of them. I've lost several buddies that, of course, as everybody has. And I was just grateful for that. And grateful that it was over for them that were doing the heavy-duty stuff. And now they get back and reacquainted with the families and start the new life. Either some stayed in the military and a lot got out. But it was a ton of weight come off your shoulders on behalf of our people in the Army and the Navy and all those that were in harm's way on behalf of freedom. It was just a new world, a new bright world out there.
You know, and as you mentioned that you were thankful for your buddies, I'm thinking back to something you told us a few minutes ago, that when you got assigned to cargo planes, you felt a little left out. Here you had dreamt about flying the fighters and all of that. Looking back now, how do you feel all about that? And does it seem to you like fighters wasn't the plan for you? And if you had been in fighters, you might not be here?
Well, that was always a possibility. So I just don't try and dwell too much on the past and say that's been done and that's the way they want it. And so you accommodate to it. But, you know, you just take the path that you're given. And if you waste time look in the rearview mirror too long, you miss the turn off on what you might become.
And what he would become would be a living, breathing example of compassion and human kindness that would have a greater impact than he could possibly have imagined. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook to learn more about the candy bomber, Gail Halverson, as well as the educational foundation that bears his name. He just turned 100, and I'm pretty sure one of the presents he received is a lot bigger than anything we've ever gotten for our birthdays. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Joining in the celebration this week of birthday number 100 for the candy bomber, Gail Halverson. The Gail S. Halverson Aviation Education Foundation will celebrate his legacy for decades to come, and do so not only by telling his story, but by providing opportunities for children to develop their STEM skills. If you're not familiar with that STEM acronym, that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I have the foundation's website linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll talk more about that a little later, but to understand why he became known around the world as the Candy Bomber, we have to let him set the scene of the Berlin airlift.
It was about 1945, at the end of the war, the way it was set up in Germany, because of the beginning of the war, they cut Germany into two pieces, the East and the West. Russians had, the Soviet Union has the East, and British, French, and Americans had Western Germany. And then the Berlin, the capital, was deep, 110 miles deep inside of East Germany. And Berlin was made up of four sectors: British, French, American, the Soviet sector. So here was an island of freedom, 110 miles deep into Soviet-controlled East Germany. It was a very unusual case. And I went to stay in the military. They asked me to stay in after the war, and I stayed in. And in that process, we'd have pilot meetings every month. And we were increasingly warned about the Soviet threat. that they hadn't disarmed like the Allies had disarmed after the war. And they were headed west, and Berlin was in the way. And then we saw the tension escalate, and we knew something was going to happen. And then they shut off all the supplies on the ground and canal system from West Berlin across East Germany to West Germany. We knew that most of the people in West Berlin were women and children, in Berlin as a whole, no matter what. Heavy losses during the war, prisoner wars, and so most of them were women and children. So I neglected to say what I felt right at that moment, because it wasn't friendly after the war, because Conrad Steffen, that I got interested in flying, as soon as Pearl Harbor, he signed up, was trained, he did get fighters. He was trained in P-47s, and he was sent to England to support the bombers over Germany. And about the fourth mission, the Germans shot Conrad down and killed him. So I had a heavy burden with the Germans and a guilty conscience. I got him started flying, and I know that he would have done it one way or another anyway. So that was a situation. And what changed totally was knowing the people were different than Hitler, and there were women and children. And so I wanted to do more, feeling I'd left out of the heavier stuff. I wanted to do more, and I volunteered to join the airlift, and was accepted, and I wasn't married by then, and I stationed at Rhein-Main in West Germany and flying into Berlin through the southern quarter. The crowd was so heavy during the startup of the airlift that all the barracks were taken. And when I got there, there was just old tar paper shacks that weren't too good. They were just being trying to refurbish some. And there was a barn, a big barn right there in Zeppelinheim, right at Rhein-Main, that had a loft in the barn, big loft, clean. And being a farm kid, I investigated the barn. It had a good floor, a cement floor under the loft. And so that was better than the old barracks they had. So me and my buddies took our beds up and slept in the barn. But even those conditions, one of my buddies in the barn had bombed Berlin during the war. And I said, "How do you feel about this thing? The war's just been over. You've been home 2 years about. Just got, so you come," and he's a family man, "come through the door, and the kids quit asking, 'Who's that guy?' You're just getting back to normal life, and then they call you back to feed the former enemy." He had been shot up over Berlin. Two of his crew members were wounded. He just barely got back to England in time to save their lives. And I said, "How do you feel about that?" And he said, "Well," he looked far off, "says it's a whole lot better to feed him than it is to kill him. I'm glad to be back." That's the reward a person gets from helping somebody in deep trouble. And a lesson in forgiveness, you know. How that affected, what that burden would have been, almost unbearable. But he was effective on the airlift. He did a great job and rotated in regular time. So attitude, gratitude, and service before self is the kind of thing that the airlift brought out in people and made it possible for them to dedicate their all to it.
And I know you lived it. You flew them all those missions, and you've been talking about it ever since and reenacting it ever since, so it's old hat for you. But for someone who's hearing about the Berlin airlift for the first time, maybe you can explain what one of those missions would have been like, what you did, what you were dropping to the folks who were cut off, and what maybe challenges you faced in the process.
Well, I got over there pretty early during the after the blockade, and as I said, I slept in a barn, no water, got a light bulb from the ceiling, go through the mud to eat to the mess hall and get a shower even. And under those conditions, the morale of the guys flying was good. What we did is, first, the requirement was 8,500 tons a day to feed over 2 million people. And for the first month, we had a terrible deficit. Therefore, the schedule was, we'd fly 3 round trips into Berlin from Rhein-Main and Frankfurt, and then sleep about 8 hours and do it again. So we were flying maximum, flying C-54s like I flew to South Atlantic. That's what the schedule looked like. Now, you might start at night or you might start in the daytime. It was tough kind of getting used to the rhythm of whenever you get there, you go to bed, get after 3 round trips. And the cargo was dried eggs, dried potatoes. Of course, one plane of dried stuff could carry as much as 3 or 4 airplanes if not dehydrated. And, of course, flour. But we also hauled a lot of coal. that comment on importance of energy. At the end, there was as much coal flowing as there was foodstuff. So we had very lucky, in a way, well, never lucky the thing started in the first place, but it's fortunate, is a better word, that it began in the early summer. The weather is the best then in Europe most of the year. If it started in the winter, we'd been in real trouble. But not long after we started flying, and I got there in early July, we got radar. We had ground-controlled radar to help us stay in the quarters, the 10-mile-wide quarters, and on the long-range radar. But better than that was ground-controlled approach, GCA. The air bases were Tempelhof in West Berlin and the British bases. The Brits had radar before we did, but the radar was the thing that really saved it. Tegel was the air base in the French sector, and Gatow was the air base in the British sector, and Tempelhof was the air base in the American sector. The thing that really saved the airlift was radar, the approach in bad weather. And later on, we had plenty of that, the ice and snow and fog. And in November of 1948, we had a real rough time. It was the first time we didn't get an increase every month. But we did better in December and January and February than we did in November. But weather was really bad then.
How exhausting was that? And what kept you going? I mean, I imagine it was fulfilling to know that people's lives depend on what you're doing and that you're helping people out that without you aren't going to have help. But do you remember what you felt during that time and what drove you, what motivated you to keep on going?
Well, the thing that motivated me the most, and of course, we were young, gosh sakes, that was good too. When we were land, be in the daytime and not in a blizzard, they'd bring a certain amount of students, young students, out to the airfield. They'd escort them, and not in huge groups, but in separate groups. And see, we'd stand right by the airplane when it was unloaded. They wouldn't let us even go in the terminal building after a while, because when that airplane was ready to go, they wanted you to start the engine right away. So we stayed with the airplane. We didn't go in the building. So they'd come around, and while we were waiting for them to unload the 20,000 pounds of flour, whatever, they'd bring some kids around. And those kids would bring us even some flowers, a few flowers in the wintertime, or make a toy they made and give to you, and look them in the eye, and they'd courtesy when they left, and give us a feeling dunk for all that you do. And those little girls and little guys look up at you with those eyes, and thank you for my bread. Man, nothing. I never ever had a misgiving about that, and being the former enemy. The children, to me, were the thing that wiped away all that anger about shooting down Conrad Stefan and about the atrocities that we knew were going on. And it was a new plate. The gratitude of the children, the just innocence. They were the ones that I remember this being the most motivating of any that we never hesitated to get back and get another load into Berlin. And the Brits were doing the same at Gatow, and the French at Tegel. Everybody was doing it. But I think that identified one change factor, it would be the children and their obvious gratitude.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's what inspired that light bulb moment for you that led to the nicknames you carry with you to this day. And I guess you're kind of like Santa Claus, because you went from dropping coal on him to dropping candy. I think he's legendary for doing some of those things. Where did this idea come from, to use one of these missions to drop candy for the kids?
Well, I got there in early July. As I said, I thought this airlift would be over. Stalin was getting the black eye in the world press. All over Soviets starving, over 2 million people, mostly women and children. He was losing ground. First of all, he thought it would fail. And with a fail, why? Then he'd win. But on one day, I came back from three round trips to Berlin about 9 o'clock in the morning to Rhein-Main, West Germany. I was supposed to go to bed and start flying that night. But my buddy, John Pickering from Mobile, who came with me, he had an airplane next to mine. Mine was empty coming in. He had one loaded about to go to Berlin. And I said, wow, this thing's going to be over pretty quick. That's how dumb I was. Going to be over pretty quick. I don't have any pictures on the ground in Berlin. I got to go to Berlin. I had a buddy with a Jeep waiting for me. If you ever get here, he says, I'll take you around and get some pictures of this bombed out city. And so I told John, I told my co-pilot, go to bed, and the crew chief, go to bed. I'll be back in time to fly to Berlin. And I'm going to Berlin. And they said, "You're crazy." And I said, "That's okay, I'm going." So I jumped on with Pickering and went to Berlin. Jeep was there. Before I wanted to go around the city with a Jeep, I wanted to get a picture of the approach. The approach was bad. They had this temple office built in the city, and there were high apartment houses all the way around it. So you had to come over the top or go between them. There's one place you can go between them with radar to get down to land quick enough. And I wanted to get the movies to come popping over those bombed-out buildings. Hiked across the field to the end of the runway. The airplane's coming right over my head, but behind me, and shooting movies of them. All of a sudden, of course, there's barbed wire fence all around to keep the kids off the runway and all the way around the field. And all of a sudden, I noticed 30 kids, about 8 to 15 years old, right at the barbed wire fence on the other side looking at the uniform, and I got it with me right here, the uniform I wore that day at the fence. And those guys, kids, boys and girls, looked at it, and they were friendly. They knew what Stalin was like. Their aunts and uncles in East Berlin, just across the border, no wall. Come back and said, "Well, you don't have anything to do with these guys." And they knew the difference. These young kids knew the difference. They were cheering me up. Says, "Now look, this is good weather in July. But when the winter comes, you're going to get ice and snow, and it's going to be hard to get in here. But when that happens, don't worry about us. We don't need enough to eat. Just give us a little. Someday we'll have enough to eat. But if we lose our freedom, we'll never get it back." Kids, 8 to 40. Some been probably in the Hitler Youth, some of them. And yet they knew the difference between freedom and having a managed government. It's going to manage your life. So those kids just blew my mind. They talked to me for about 45 minutes or almost an hour. And I said, "I got to go. I had the Jeep waiting for me, take me around town." I said, "Don't worry about it. We'll never give up on you. Good to see you." Most of them spoke English. There's some English. And we had a translator, a kid that translated too. He says, "Don't worry, we never give up." And took off. Got about 50 yards and a voice came to me, clear as a bell. You know, "Wow, that was interesting. How come?" And then it came to me immediately. It's the first time during the war and after that I've flown in a foreign country. The kids that age hadn't mobbed you. There's an American uniform, that's a soft touch. They got chocolate or gum, and they'd grab you going down the street in different countries. Since George Washington, troops going down the street in a different place, handing out candy to kids, that's nothing different. That's been forever. George Washington's troops did the same thing. But then when it hit me was, they had me stop dead, and not by voice inflection or body language or even any clue did they say, "Don't you know we like kids like chocolate? We don't have any chocolate. For a couple of years, we don't have any chocolate where we go just go buy it." And when I realized that not one child had broke ranks and they were so grateful for a flower to be free, they wouldn't be a beggar for more, it blew my mind. I just couldn't. And I said, "Holy cow." So I thought, "I hope I got something." And I reached in my pocket hurriedly, and all I find is two sticks of Wrigley's Double Mint Gum. And I hesitated a minute, and I took off again.
But that is not how that encounter ended. And who knew that two little sticks of gum could change the world? If you've read his book, The Berlin Candy Bomber, you know how that happened, but you'll hear it from Colonel Halvorsen himself when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, "One of these days I'm going to do something with those"? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, catching up this week with the Candy Bomber, 100-year-old Gail Halvorsen, who earned that nickname for his actions during the Berlin airlift, actions that would spur a movement that ultimately helped turn the tide of world opinion. When we left off, he was talking about the group of German children he'd been speaking to on the other side of a barbed wire fence in Berlin. He had just two sticks of gum in his pocket, not nearly enough, he thought, to please all those kids.
I said, two sticks, you're going to have bloody noses. Get out of here. Two sticks are not going to make any difference, and they're just going to get these kids with a bloody nose. I got about 50 feet of that, and the voice clear as a bell. Just no equivocation. Go back to the fence. Just like a command. I hear that voice now. No hesitation. Go back to the fence. Well, I turned around, and when I did, those kids just grabbed the barbed wire and waited, and we got there, and I pulled it out, and boy, they watched every move broken in half and passed to the kids that did some of the translating, and here come the rush. And I thought, oh, dear, be careful. A lot of little girls, and they were kind. They asked for a piece of the wrapper, and the kids that got a half a stick carefully tore off the outer wrapper and the tin foil. I stood there, dumbfounded, and passed out the strips of paper to the other kids that didn't get any gum. And the kids would put that up to their nose and smell it. And I turned to leave. They had it crumpled up in their hand to take back to show mother if she still, or if dad, well, dad, not too many dads, to show them what they found at the fence that day in Berlin, a piece of wrapper on a half a stick of gum. When I saw that, it just blew my mind. I said, boy, for 50 cents, I could put on an easy street, give them a full stick of gum to keep the wrapper. And then the red light came on. Well, you should be in bed now. I had a good co-pilot. I should have been in bed in Rhein-Main that moment. But I had a great co-pilot, John Pickering, and I knew that he could find his way to Berlin. I'd be awake that time. So instead of going to bed, I went back. I had to go back and start flying. Anyway, those kids, it was just unbelievable in their attitude and gratitude. So that's how it started there.
Well, and I'm sure you had no idea what it was going to turn into and how big a deal it would become. I mean, here you just have this innocent idea, and you talk about hearing voices in your head. You think that was lack of sleep, or do you have some other explanation for that?
I belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and we call that the Holy Ghost. The Holy Ghost rides with you and helps you, prompts you what path to take, and that where you end up is if you follow the GPS of the Holy Ghost, then you're going to end up in a pretty good place. So, well, I did. I got in trouble. I came back the next day over the field, and they said, how do we know what airplane you're in? And there's airplane every 5 minutes, and we'll be tired if you don't get in soon. And I said, when I came over the field, I wiggle the wings like I did over the farm when I got my pilot license, showed Dad that was me. My dog, I had a black shepherd dog, and he'd chase airplanes, and I see my dog chasing my airplane from down below. But so he said, I'll wiggle the wings, and that'll know that I'm there. And that's how we communicated first.
How much candy did you end up dropping? And how amazed were you when you saw the impact that it had on awareness, not just there in Germany, but around the world, and what kind of dent that made?
Well, I started out with two sticks of gum, and it ended up, we couldn't buy much chocolate. All we could was ration. And so we could buy just so much every week. And so my buddies gave me their ration, and then for 3 weeks we dropped it. And the crowd got bigger and bigger and bigger. Came back from Berlin one day to Rhein-Main, an officer met the airplane. Come steaming on board. He said, who's flying this airplane? My buddy pointed to me. He is. Why? Colonel Hahn wants to see you right now. What for? He'll tell you what for. Colonel Hahn and Halvorsen. I flew for him in Mobile, and he came over to Lieutenant Colonel, the head boss. And he says, Halvorsen, well, what have you been doing? I said, flying like mad, sir. I'm not stupid, he said. What else you been doing? And then I knew he knew. He pulled out of the newspaper, threw it on the counter, German Berlin paper, right on the front page of my airplane, parachutes coming out of it, kids lined up the barbed wire fence. I said, holy cow. Oh, Halvorsen, why didn't you tell me about that? He says, sir, there's no excuse. I had Utah State. I had two quarters of ROTC. There's no excuse for an act like that. No excuse, sir. So he said, well, General Tunner called me up. The big boss, General Tunner, called him up and said, "Hon, what have you been doing dropping parachutes over Berlin? Old General, you know we're not dropping any over Berlin. We're unloading all the coal and food on the ground. They got an unloading crews. We wouldn't drop it over, pulverize it, or hit somebody. We're unloading it." He said, "Colonel, you better find out what's going on in your outfit." Clunk. What I found out from that in my military career is don't try and impress your boss's boss. Work on your boss. Well, I didn't want to impress anybody. I didn't want anybody to know about it. So that's how I found out about it. And then we went crazy. The guys in the States sent stuff. All the schools sent things to Chicopee, Massachusetts. They tied up everything and sent it over ready to drop. So the candy companies, Hershey was the biggest one, that they'd say, "How much of this you want?" And we'd give them some ridiculous number, and they sent it. So we sent it up to Chicopee, and then the school kids from all around the area, Chicopee, Mass., would come in and tie up with these things in big cardboard boxes and put them on the airplanes going over from Westover, mostly Westover Air Force Base, over the Rhine Main. And then we would lock it up and load it up with my buddies to give them a map of how to find it and how to different places so we didn't drop it all the same place. But that's how we distributed that much candy. It was 23 tons. 20 tons dropped in that time, and 5 tons at Christmas time distributed on the ground to the Christmas parties on the ground. The ultimate sacrifice was the 31 Americans that were killed during the blockade and 39 Brits that gave their lives to the former enemy.
Yeah, and who's to say you wouldn't have become one of them, but instead what you became was a legendary figure, especially in Germany. When you finished that tour over there, when the blockade had ended and some kind of normalcy was restored and you headed back to the States, was it hard to fathom just how big a deal this was and how that one little idea and those 2 sticks of gum turned into such a worldwide phenomenon?
I never did. I still don't understand it. I still don't understand it. Small things precede that, which is great, and it was a very small thing. And I just came back from Utah to a huge celebration there, and Kitty Hawk, to fly the Berlin Airlift Memorial Airplane, Spirit of Freedom, with Tim Shope, the founder, dropping memorial flowers for those who were killed, and also candy bars to kids, as usual. So it's still going on. I'm still as amazed as I ever was. But there's nothing quite like getting a candy bar coming out of the sky, even though they got plenty they can buy in the store. To see those parachutes come out, it's amazing how they look. When you hold, drop 50 pounds of candy bars on parachutes, and the kids chase them like the kids did in Berlin. Just run after him. It's a sort of a magic thing, but it has surprised me a great deal. But it's fun doing it to see the kids today. And I talk to a lot of schools and show them the old movies I took of the airlift, and the kids still relate to it.
Well, it's got to be every kid's dream to catch a candy bar falling from the sky. I mean, I think there's whole books written about that idea. But this has turned into a defining part of your life, and it's allowed you to meet presidents of our country and other countries. It's taken you all over the world. Out of all of that, what are you most grateful for? And how long are you going to keep doing this and keep doing all these reenactments and telling your story and going here and there and everywhere like a jet setter?
Well, I couldn't be more grateful for all the great, wonderful support, the schools all over the United States. Without them, we wouldn't have those parachutes to use. Grateful for the support of the children, the American children. And I've had letters from kids that lost their dad in the war in Germany. And yet they said that as bad as they felt, they thought it was a healing influence. But I was very grateful for the people that have made it easy for me to keep flying, and for Heavenly Father for me be able to keep flying. I'm not the first pilot, I'm the co-pilot on the airplane, and to go around and meet the kids. And it brings back the memory of those kids back during the blockade, to see them running after the parachutes today. So one thing I've taken from this is that fulfillment in life doesn't come from more money or a newer car or a bigger house than a neighbor. And the real fulfillment comes from serving others. The dead sea's dead because it wraps its arms around all the fresh water that comes in and gives out nothing. And wherever you live, United States or other places, you'll find Dead Sea souls. When they said, first of all, if somebody is in need, they say, "Well, what do you give me?" Find out what the reward will be before they act And that cuts off that the real blessing, the greater blessing. So service before self is the antidote. Service before self, you see the need, do what one can without question for the maximum benefit, maximum reward. The other thing is gratitude. Gratitude is the elixir that breaks down barriers between people. It shows a consideration for somebody besides yourself. And showing that gratitude, like the children, silent gratitude, their lack of saying, gimme, gimme, their silent gratitude was more powerful than a verbal one. Gratitude, attitude, service before self, and small decision. Like I said, put your footsteps on the path at least to where you end up, for good or bad. Those are the things that the airlift taught me and affected my life, has for since that time and still does. It changed hatred to friendship.
I know that you're not looking for attention, you're not bragging about anything, and you're going to be hesitant to probably give me an honest answer on this. But what's it like when you go back to Germany? The reception that you get, the way people react to you, even now? Can you give us a taste of what that's like for you, how they react to seeing you and hearing your name? And maybe you can even say that in German. What do they call you in German?
Uncle Wackelflügel means Uncle Wiggly Wings. The Schokoladenflieger, the chocolate pilot. Because of this, there's a Gail S. Halvorsen School in Berlin. It's a wonderful school, and these kids have been supportive and go back there, and it's like homecoming. And they've done so many good things for me when I go back, and the parades that they have, the kids turn out especially, well, and the old folks that were there doing the blockade. Every time I go back to Berlin, I run into more than one on most occasions that was there and tell me how they caught the parachute. One boy with a lot of stories about that, but he's going to school and through the clouds came the parachute. But problem was, there's a little pond right there, a land in the pond. So he rushed right out in the pond over his knees to get the parachute. He went to school and the teacher's chewing him out. When the boy told her what happened, why she let him go home and get some dry clothes. But all the letters, there's too many letters to mention. Well, for a farm kid that didn't have inside plumbing until he got in high school, I never forgot that. But it is a joy to go back and hear a different story from someone I had not met before. It's been wonderful. I just want to be able to keep going as long as I can, and then when I can't do it anymore, to get out of the limelight. But I just want to do what I can, and the point X, I'm going to retire. I've been saying that for quite a while.
That's what he was saying at 95, and not too much has changed since then, as you heard earlier from now 100-year-old Gail Halvorsen. After a drive-by birthday parade to celebrate that century mark, this father of five, grandfather to 24, great-granddad to more than 60, and Uncle Wiggly Wings to more than he could count, was honored with a larger-than-life mural in Tremont in Utah. That's where he first caught the aviation bug, seeing planes fly over while he was working on his father's sugar beet farm. And now, in downtown Tremont, the 76-foot-wide facade of a brick building features a mural of Colonel Halvorsen in front of a giant, half-wrapped chocolate bar, like the ones he and his fellow pilots dropped millions of to German children more than 70 years ago. I have some news coverage of that mural unveiling linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And when I caught up with the chocolate flyer himself this week, I had to ask what it felt like to see that enormous tribute in Tremont.
Well, it felt like it somebody remembered, and that's quite a long time ago, and I flew the airlift and other activities in the war, and I thought, my gosh, that's pretty neat. Here it is, this far after the war, and people are still remembering. I thought that was really neat.
Well, and they're going to remember for a long, long time. I think the question I'd love to hear you answer is, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now, when somebody drives by that mural or they participate in the Gail Halvorsen Education Center, you know.
I have a warm spot in my heart wherever I am.
What do you hope that people understand or take away from it when they see that painting or they hear your story and they understand what you and others did so long ago?
I tell them that there's a few things in life that are really important. It's hard to pick out the best, but attitude, gratitude, and service before self is the way for happiness. If you get the right attitude and don't get off the track there, and gratitude, be grateful. You just the world didn't get this way by itself. Those who've gone before, attitude, gratitude, and service, serving others. There's no better or surer way of feeling good about yourself than helping somebody that needs it. That was the Berlin Airlift. The Berliners needed to stay free. Flew day and night, and I never flew so many hours in the shortest time than that, but I never felt better about it. So the little things in life are important. They make the life meaningful. I think that's what I've learned in life, in the Air Force for 31 years. It's a great life. Good people out there in the United States of America, no place like it. I'm so grateful to have that opportunity to live here and to leave here on occasion in different circumstances and see what the rest of the world's like. We're an exception in how we're governed. Glad I was born in the United States of America.
Amen. You just shared some of the things you've learned in 100 years of life, but I'm curious if there's anything you're still looking forward to.
Oh, yeah. There's a different world out there, and people have different opinions, and we just got to remember how blessed we are to be in the USA.
Well, people like you have made it a better place to live, so thank you for your example and your words. Is there anything else you want people to know from a centenarian?
No, just tell them that they should stop at night before they go to bed and say their prayers and pray that our system of government can be maintained and the people we elect are the best people. I'm just grateful every day I wake up that I'm an American.
An exemplary American, Gail Halvorsen, now 100 years old, but looking forward to the next time he can hop inside a C-54 and once again reenact what he did all those years ago. Perhaps that'll happen in Spanish Fork, Utah, where the Gail S. Halvorsen Aviation Education Foundation is raising money now for a permanent home, a building where young people will be able to come and not just learn about the Candy Bomber's powerful example, but also learn robotics, rocketry, and other STEM disciplines. If that's a mission you'd like to support, I have the foundation's website linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, or you can go directly there if you type in thecandybomber.org. That's all the time we have today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.